The 3D Advisor Success Series was produced by 3DL Capital Management. Double Line Capital was granted permission for use in its platforms. Double Line may have altered the content to meet regulatory requirements.
Hello, and welcome to 3DL Capital Management and the Advisor Success Series podcast. My name is John O'Connor, and I am co-founder and president of 3DL Capital, a member of the Freedom Advisors Group. These podcasts are for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice and are not an offer to sell or purchase any investment or security. Remember that any investment will involve risk. The views expressed in the podcasts are those of the participants and do not constitute investment or tax advice. I hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Hi, this is Ben Levine with 3DL Capital Management. Welcome to our Advisor Success Series podcast. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Ken Shinoda, who's the head of structured products at Double Line Capital Management and works closely with Jeff Gunlock, the CIO, and Jeff Sherman, the deputy CIO. Is one of the portfolio managers on the total return strategies. And it's a pleasure to have you on, Ken, because there is certainly a lot to talk about here in the fixed income markets.
Been a crazy couple weeks here, and thanks for having me, Ben. It's a pleasure to be
here. Sure. So, Ken, I did give a bit about your role at Double Line, but why don't you share with our listeners your background and what you do at Double Line?
Sure. I kind of jumped right into the mortgage-backed securities industry, I guess by just maybe pure luck or chance. I was attending the University of Southern California in the business program there for undergrad, and I needed an internship, get something on my resume. I had a friend working at TCW at the time, and started there as an intern, and they were kind of growing in that asset-backed CDO market, and ended up joining that group that was managing asset-backed CDOs, and that was right before the global financial crisis, so I saw the crazy growth of the subprime mortgage market, which ended up leading into the global financial crisis, which I joke was my MBA. I didn't need to go back to business school. Just having lived through that and traded mortgage-backed securities during that time period was really all the education you need. And I moved from trading into portfolio management, but I've been with the team and Jeffrey Gunlock since really the beginning of my career. And it's been quite a ride, and it's been a pleasure building out the Double Line franchise that we have built out today.
Great. So let's dig right into it. Today is March 24th. It seems like day to day, the headlines keep hitting over what's going on with the financials, what's going on with banking. This morning, we learned that the European banks were under pressure because of Deutsche Bank now. Before that, it was Credit Suisse, which was subsequently taken over by UBS and in an arranged deal by the Swiss regulatory authority. So with all that, summarize for us, what is going on with the U.S. banking situation? What is going on with Europe? And then how does the firm Double Line really kind of look at this from a macro and a market impact standpoint?
Sure. I mean, what's interesting is this: the problem that faced Silicon Valley Bank and many of these other banks, it didn't start 3 weeks ago when SVB went under. It started when the Fed started hiking interest rates. So really, kind of like last year, one of my good friends, it's a bond salesman that covers banks, one of the big banks out there, one of the regional banks, selling them mortgage-backed securities. He stopped selling bonds to these banks. They all stopped buying because they were all worried about their deposits leaving. This deposit flight has been going on for quite some time. You know, the Fed raises rate, Fed funds goes higher, but if you actually go and you check your Chase savings account, the rate that they pay you is sticky to the downside, right? I teach a class at USC, and I actually went with my students and I said, hey, let's go do an exercise. Let's go online and see how much Chase will pay you. And when you Google Chase savings, they pay you, you ready for this? 1 basis point. Now, I know if you have more money there, like they give you like a special rate because you have like more than a certain amount of dollars there, but the banks are really sticking on moving that. And deposits had already started leaving. They're going to places like money markets. They're going to places like T-bills, of course, everyone's favorite trade, the 6-month T-bill. And what happens is, as short-term rates rise and as bond prices of longer duration assets that banks have to own high quality liquid assets that they can trade, right? Things like treasuries, agency mortgage-backed securities. Short-term rates went up. Long-term rates also went up. So all those safe government bonds went down in price pretty dramatically. Fannie twos and two and a halves, which is a lot of what was on the SVB balance sheet, got all the way down into the high 70s, low 80s dollar price. So they're sitting there with a portfolio of bonds that don't have really any coupon on them, two and a half coupon. They're carrying around, you know, 275 or so on that dollar price. And meanwhile, their funding costs, short-term rates keep going higher and higher. So they have a negative arbitrage, right? Their bond cash flows cannot cover the financing rate of putting those securities they own into different financing facilities. And a lot of them finance at the Federal Home Loan Banks. And so even before Silicon Valley Bank went under, this problem of this negative carry relative to funding costs was already happening. And it was a stress. Now, what really sped up the stress was the flight of deposits. You know, prior to what happened with SVB, there was a slow trickle out. You know, people would wake up to the fact that, you know, they could earn way more on money markets and T-bills, and they were slowly moving their money out. And SVB was very unique in that its depositor base was not mom and pop. Its depositor base was very tech, VC oriented, healthcare. And we all know that those companies could not raise money in the IPO market anymore, kind of the VC markets that kind of shut down. And so they were just burning through cash. And once it was apparent that there was more of a problem there, they all exited immediately. I mean, to put things into perspective, $42 billion went out in one night, whereas when Washington Mutual went down in 2008, which was the largest bank to go under prior to the SVB incident, it took 10 business days for them to lose $17 billion. And I think a lot of it really has to do with technology. Like, everyone has their phones on hand, they can click, 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 move your money. But that's kind of really what happened, was they were already in pain. All banks were in pain because of that inverted yield curve and having these mark-to-market losses on long-duration bonds that they own. SVB just happened to own more of those than most banks. They had a larger percentage of their book in those bonds that went down in price, and then their assets left quicker than we've ever seen happen in a bank run ever.
Yeah, but what I find interesting is that this happened all of a sudden. Sure, it started as early as last year when the Fed first started raising rates and long-term rates started to rise. But we've had like a negative yield curve for, I would say, 6 to 9 months now, it seems. The last time I remember it being steep was back in March when the Fed first started raising rates, but it's been inverted since then. Why the deposit flight, or the now we know the term deposit beta, why did that come to a head this month when it seems like this inverted yield curve has been in place for quite a while? And frankly, money market fund yields were rising, and anyone could put money in T-bills, which were yielding more and more over the last year. Why all of a sudden today, as opposed to, you know, 6 or 9 months ago?
Yeah, I really think it just has to do with, you know, bad news coming out of the bank. They had to raise that capital. Usually when banks have to raise capital, there's something wrong going on. And the second that the depositors there sniffed trouble, they all rushed to the exit as soon as possible. And I don't think the prevalence of utilization of social media like Twitter with the depositor base, a lot of VC, a lot of tech, they're all on Twitter all the time. So they basically are, they see one person saying, you got to get out, and then everyone wants to get out. So I think that exacerbated the stress on that particular bank relative to, let's say, like a First Republic, PacWest, or one of the other ones that are in the headlines these days, right?
So now we're in this situation where deposits are fleeing for either a money market fund or a treasury account. And but regulators are attempting to try and ring fence this issue, saying it's idiosyncratic, setting up support facilities like the bank term facility program, which is essentially a 1-year discount window.
Yeah.
Is it possible to ring fence something like Silicon Valley or First Republic, which is another regional bank that's been in the headlines under a lot of stress? Or is this really systemic across much of the regional bank base? Because the tier one banks aren't facing this issue. They have a much more diversified deposit base, more diversified source of revenue. They certainly have excess reserves parked at the Fed balance sheet that they're getting paid interest on. How does the small mid-sized banking system survive all this if they don't have the diversified risk levers that the tier one banks have, the reserves on the balance sheet and so forth? How is this ring fenced?
Yeah, well, I go back to even before Silicon Valley Bank, I think that you were going to see consolidation and M&A within the regional banking system as some of these stressed banks, depending on how their asset liability framework were probably going to, you know, join together and merge and grow. This incident just basically, I think it brought forward to mom and pop out there, hey, maybe I'm at risk in these regional banks, and that's not helping the deposit flight. You know, some of it is going to money markets and T-bills, some of it's just going to Chase, right? Some of it's going to Wells Fargo, because people are saying, you know, do I really want to risk being in these regional banks? And it's really funny, because after the global financial crisis, at least down here in Southern California, First Republic has a pretty big presence. That was the safe bank to go to. It was the big money center banks that were doing all the CDOs and the subprime and the bad lending. Those regional banks were like the ones that kept the balance sheets clean. So it's just really ironic that now it's some of those regional banks that money is fleeing about. Now, I think a lot of them are fine. I think that the ones that are in the headlines, it really has to do with kind of the average balance of their deposits. First Republic is on the larger end. It's got probably $1 million average deposit versus most regional banks probably have more under that FDIC $250,000 limit. And then the market is, you know, the equity market's basically punishing banks that have more exposure to tech and more exposure to, you know, commercial lending and things like that right now. So I don't think we're going to see a mass wave of bank failures immediately. Obviously, if the Fed and the Treasury and the government, and FDIC don't support the market, that could happen. But it seems like they've come in pretty aggressively. So I think that's a good thing. The bigger risk that I see to the kind of the macro picture is that if I'm a bank CFO, CEO, I am worried about that deposit flight, right? We're starting to see the deposit flight slow down a little bit, but I'd still be worried. So on the margin, I got to believe they're going to lend less. So I think this is the at least for me, 2-3 weeks ago when this happened, everyone was so focused on SVB and saying, oh, this is an isolated issue. For me, it was more like, now this has changed the psychology of depositor, and it's changed the psychology of bank operators, that I've got to believe that the cost of funding has gone up for small business. And regional banks are huge lenders to small business. Small business is 46% of employment in the U.S. And they're also really big lenders in commercial real estate, which is, you know, in the headlines that I'm sure we'll talk about later. Something like 39% of regional bank balance sheets sits in commercial loans, commercial real estate loans, whereas the money center banks is more like 6-7%. Obviously, the money center banks are much bigger, but that just kind of gives you an idea of you. I think you will see a pullback in business lending. I think you'll see a pullback in commercial lending, and that's going to be pretty contractionary on the economy. So I've turned way more negative over the last 3 weeks than I was, let's say, a month ago. And the bond market's kind of corroborating that view, right?
Yeah, I mean, the next trouble spot everyone seems to be pointing at right now are the BBB tranches of CMBS, which is commercial mortgage backs. And the thinking being is that this is subprime 2.0, where if you see the collapse in subordinated lending, the tranches that support overall borrowing within this space, if you see those collapse, then pretty much the whole edifice of commercial bank financing collapses with it. We'll get into specific sectors in a moment, but I do want to stay focused on kind of the big picture macro, the market impact. The estimate is that there are about 8 trillion of uninsured deposits in the banking system. And what caused a bit of a sell-off, apart from the March Federal Reserve meeting where they raised interest rates to their benchmark rate to 5%. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was giving congressional testimony where right during the Jay Powell's press conference, she blurted out that there is nothing being contemplated at the moment for blanketed deposit support. And that really led to the market selling off,
yeah,
particularly the banking sector. So let's kind of talk about this notion of deposit coverage. A, it needs congressional approval. It's not just something that can be handled through the regulatory bodies or through existing facilities set up at the Treasury. Really only meant to deal with temporary dislocations. Is there not only the political will to increase depositor protections, but in reality, is there the fiscal capacity to be able to do that if we're talking $8 trillion of uninsured deposits? How does politically something like this happen?
I think you would need to see more bank failures for that to happen politically. I think she just kind of misspoke. I think what she wanted to say is kind of what you described in that she doesn't really have the power to do that, right? It needs to be approved by Congress. And I think today, I didn't get the chance to watch it, but I think she kind of made new remarks on the topic. That, you know, it's really kind of like case by case. Like if First Republic's going down, they'll support those depositors as well. So I think that's their game plan for now, is just do it on a case by case basis, right?
And they have the capacity to do it with the BTFP and with the FDIC being able to increasingly or temporarily cover all deposits on a case by case basis. It's just trying to imagine how that would be done if you see more and more banks going into receivership.
Yeah, I mean, you would need to get both sides of the aisle to come to an agreement, and it just seems like an improbable event at this point in time, given all the drama in Washington. So I think the case by case is probably what we have now. And the important thing to watch is that balance sheet. So you do get a release, I think it's weekly, called the H41 from the Fed, mm-hmm. that talks about the utilization of the different...
Which is slowing down, like you said.
It's slowing down. Go ahead.
We're seeing money go from the discount window to the BTFP, which makes sense. It's anonymous. It's 1 year term as opposed to 90 days, less of a stigma. So hopefully, you know, the fact that it's slowing down, you're not seeing a major uptick in that facility suggests that perhaps a depositor flight at the margin is starting to slow down. Europe. So just like with Silicon Valley, Credit Suisse collapse seemed like it happened overnight. I mean, we know that for several years now, it's been a kind of the problem child of European banking with its fines and scandals. But what really kind of set it off was the fact that they were seeing massive deposit outflows on a daily basis, to the point where the Swiss regulatory authorities had to step in. And over the weekend, we saw basically a brokered arrangement where UBS would take over Credit Suisse, and as a result, a certain tier of capital called additional tier one capital got wiped out, which was somewhat unprecedented given the pecking order of capital. But walk through with us what is going on in Europe, why the sudden collapse in Credit Suisse, and why are we starting to see this spill over into other banks like Deutsche Bank?
Well, Credit Suisse, I think, was a unique situation. As you mentioned, like, they have been falling apart for like the last 20 years. I mean, if you look at their stock price, it's just been like a one-way train downward. And not that other European banks haven't been in the same situation. And it comes back to almost that same issue of that negative carry situation that U.S. banks are in with funding costs. You know, you buy a mortgage-backed security, it goes down to 80, it's carrying it 2.5, 2.75. When you go to finance it with the home loan bank, you were paying almost 5% a couple of weeks ago. You think about European banks, like, they, regulation actually forces them to buy certain assets. You have to own highly liquid tradable assets, and they were being forced to buy low and negative yielding government debt in the European banking system. And those bonds are down a lot in price too. So I think it's a combination of the same type of thing happening, in which their assets that they own are down a lot. You know, people say, well, oh, they should have hedged it. Well, if you hedge low yielding bonds, you end up with no return. So it's kind of hard to, you know, hedge all those risks out. And now they're dealing with the same deposit flight that the US is dealing. So I think the entire kind of global banking system and in places where you do have short-term rates rising and long-term rates have risen as well. So asset prices are down. They're all kind of facing the same problem. And CS and Deutsche Bank, you know, these are not new names with problems. I mean, if you go back just a couple of years ago, Deutsche Bank stock was looking, you know, a little suspect as well. So I think it's, you know, some legacy stuff that's finally come home to roost, along with just this deposit flight that, you know, we're facing here in the US as well.
So let's talk about this past week's FOMC, where the Fed raised rates to 5%. And both in the statement and in the press conference, they reiterated their commitment to have slowing down inflation as their top priority while being mindful of the banking stress. And it was interpreted by the markets that the Fed was very close to pausing, not raising rates anymore. And increasingly now it looks like this is it. And we're now looking at the possibility that they're going to cut rates as soon as June, not to mention that we're going to see like 4 or 5 rate cuts by the end of the year. Jeff Gundlach, the CIO of Double Line, came out and basically said that there is such a large disconnect right now between what the market expects Fed policy rates to be versus what the Fed is communicating, that it almost kind of seems like that the Fed needs to acknowledge the inevitable. And what are your own thoughts about why policy rates, not just in the US, but in Europe, remain tight despite the issues that we're now starting to see make their way through the transmission of higher rates into like the banking system, for instance? One of the things I would point out is that inflation, although it is slowing down, remains sticky, remains elevated. And if you look at like inflation surprises, whether it was the February releases in the US or the most recent releases in the UK showing 10% year-over-year inflation, Germany still struggling with 8% plus year-over-year, that policymakers seem like they're in a bind. It really feels like they're in a box here that they didn't have to contend with in prior rate cycles when, you know, they were either raising rates or lowering rates within the backdrop of a 2% inflation. And in Europe is even less than that. How do the policymakers address the ongoing inflationary pressures while now having to deal with stresses that show up in the banking system?
It's a good question. I think part of the problem they have is that data is lagged. And so the events of Silicon Valley Bank, like, it will take time for us to see the slowdown effects of the banks pulling back on lending and how that transmits through to the economy. So, you know, and even inflation is backwards looking. So you would think that the pullback in lending will send a, you know, contractionary impulse through the economy, which will lead through to a deflationary impulse, which will bring down inflation, again, backwards looking number that we track. So I guess what they need to do, which is probably not what they will do, but what they need to do is they need to kind of look forward and try to see that the growth slowdown will probably accelerate. The problem is that they need
to. Powell did acknowledge that, right? In his press conference, he did actually say he expects the slowdown in bank lending to kind of act like a tightening mechanism akin to a rate hike.
But I feel like he's hesitant to cut until he sees more data, right? Mm-hmm. Not going to just cut next month unless we really see data slowing down. So I think what it's really going to take is either, you know, more bank failures or for us to actually see some data that's been surprising to the upside, suddenly surprise to the downside. And that will help, you know, I think lead him to start moving in the other direction. I mean, the bond market's saying, you know, you got to cut soon, right? Bad things are happening. That's what the bond market's saying. That's why you're seeing this kind of bull steepening, which is really historically has been a harbinger of, you know, bad things to come. So I think that that's something that we're looking at and saying, you know, the bond market's often right, and that it's basically estimating that we're very close to being into a recession at this point in time, right?
It is and it isn't. I mean, if you look at what Fed funds futures have done since the beginning of the year, it's almost like the cat chasing the laser. Every new data point that seems to come in resets expectations on where the bond market thinks the terminal Fed funds is going to be, where rates are going to be a year from now. So in some ways, it does feel like the bond market knows more than the Fed, but at the same time, it's just reacting to the latest data, correct? And if the labor market continues to remain strong, maybe bank lending slows down, but doesn't, we don't see sort of a wholesale collapse and asset prices hold up, then perhaps the Fed needs to be mindful of that potential second wave of inflation risk that that Fed officials keep, you know, harkening back on, and that occurred in the mid to late 70s, and Volcker's mistake and preemptively trying to pause and cut rates on the first signs of an inflation slowdown, only to be met with higher inflation in the following wave.
Yeah, could be. I mean, it is, as you note, pretty remarkable how many times we've repriced the terminal rate, right? We were like sub 4, went all the way up to almost 5.75, and now here we are back to where we are today, but basically like just inside 5, right?
Yeah, I think 3.5 by next January is what the market's now expecting. So 1.5% between now and January.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's what was the keeping me less negative prior to the SVB event, was like labor market was looking pretty strong, right? You know, job openings were high, unemployment was still low. You know, you had a couple surprises in the economic data, retail sales surprised the upside. You had PMI services, which is what I think is driving wages in the inflation component of, you know, services, CPI. You know, it's going to take time for that to probably slow down. But it's, you know, I think it all comes down to small business. A small business is a big driver of the U.S. economy. It's the Fortune 500 companies that, you know, you see in the headlines laying people off. But you know, the tech is like a microcosm of the economy. I think they make up like 3% of the workforce. So yes, Facebook lays off 25,000 people or whatever, but that's not, you know, America. America is really driven by small business. So I think that's kind of, if you can nail when that slowdown will happen, you're going to nail when that recession really starts. But by the time small business is firing, the recession's here, right? So it's a tough balance. So what, as an investor, I guess, what can you do? So I think the risks of the risks of a harder landing have increased. So I think, you know, to the extent rates back up here, you know, try to add some high quality, longer duration bonds to your portfolio. A lot of people are just still sitting in those T-bills. And the T-bills, while they don't go down in price, they also don't go up in price. So I think if we get a backup in here in rates, you know, people should be thinking about adding to high quality bonds in their portfolio and adding some kind of downside protection, right?
Yeah. So this, I think, would be a good segue into your neck of the woods, which is structured products, securitized lending. So what we mean by securitized lending is collateral backed lending. Think auto loans, credit cards, equipment leasing, residential mortgages, commercial mortgages. When we look at the rest of the fixed income landscape outside of treasuries, it feels like there's this bifurcation taking place where when you look at the overall returns of the bond market, they're very positive this month because of the drop in interest rates, but that's mainly treasury driven, right? It's treasuries that are performing and outperforming the broader market because when you look at spreads on investment grade corporates, when you look at spreads, nominal spreads on mortgages, even option adjusted spreads on mortgages, they're elevated. They've been lagging or underperforming the market. If we are looking at a hard landing scenario here, why would you want to be invested in anything but treasuries at this point? Because presumably spreads would widen even further from here, reflecting stress in the structured product space.
Well, it depends where you are on the curve, how much you think rates are going to fall, and how much you think spreads are going to widen. Because if you look historically at equity drawdowns, corporate bonds, just to use them as a benchmark, since everyone probably owns a little bit, they don't do that bad because the duration is often enough to offset the spread widening, right? So spreads, while spreads may widen, let's just say 100 basis points, it's highly likely that rates also fall 100 basis points. So you end up just washing out your price decline and earning your carry. The riskier the credit, obviously, the more potential for probably spread widening. So it's just a matter of, you know, where it sits on the curve. So actually, bonds at the front end of the curve, I think, are almost safer because there's more room for short-term rates to fall. We've got some AAA rated non-agency securities. Also, you could play in the asset-backed space in the front end of the curve at consumer receivables and things like that, where they're, you know, they're trading at like, they were all the way up at like 7.5-8 yield in October of last year when we kind of were at the wides and spreads and the local highs and rates then. And we just looked at them and said, it's so hard to lose when you buy 2-year paper at an 8 yield, right? Especially high quality. Because, okay, if rates go up, and that point in time, people thought rates were going to go up till eternity, right? Like rates could have gone up 200 more basis points. You have a yield of 8. You lose 4 points. You end the year positive 4% total return. Vice versa, if bad things are happening and you thought spreads were going to widen more, my argument was, well, if you think spreads on these AAAs is widening 200, don't you think the 2 years down 200, which it almost is now, at least 130 were down from the local highs of 5%. So it depends on what type of credit you buy, where it is on the curve, how much spread widening with relative to how much rates will fall in that scenario. So up in credit, you're going to have less risk. Down in credit, you're obviously going to have more risk, but you could end up being better off in high yield bonds, even at these levels, than owning equities. So it's just all a matter of kind of relative to what, right? Relative to cash, obviously more risk, but relative to equities, you could be better off in a portfolio of riskier credit assets relative to an equity portfolio, right? Mm-hmm.
The high cost of short-term financing, though, I would imagine it's got to be squeezing the arbitrage aspect within the structured product space. And if you're a borrower, ultimately, which is where all this ends up at, you're a below investment grade borrower trying to finance, use the credit markets to help sort of finance your growth projections, you're paying a pretty dear cost at this point. And who knows if your cash flows are able to be sufficient enough to cover that high borrowing cost. Even if rates are coming down on the long end, the fact is that short rates remain elevated. I mean, could that in itself kind of present potential systemic risk to the underlying credit structures that are heavily leveraged?
Well, the nice thing about the securitized market is that we create bankruptcy remote vehicles, right? So it doesn't really matter who made the auto loan. They could go under. Once the loans are made and they're put into the bond structure, my exposure are the loans and the borrowers. So when I'm analyzing, while it's nice for the issuer not to go bankrupt, of course, it's all about the cash flows of the underlying assets, right? We had bonds where many of the originators during the global financial crisis are clearly no longer in business, yet some of those bonds could have been money good. So it's really about the underlying asset. What you described, where I think it's a bigger problem, really is in the corporate world, in floating rate debt, right? Borrowers that, if you think about the bank loan market, the average spread on the bank loan index going back about 10 years is around 500. And outside of a little blip in 2018, when we, you know, hiked rates until Powell had to pivot, short-term rates have basically been almost zero, like for, you know, the last decade. So borrowing costs were relatively low for those companies. And all of a sudden, you've got short-term rates up at 5 now. So the cost of financing is effectively doubled for borrowers in the bank loan space. So I think the higher that short-term rates stay where they are, not only is that bad for banks, as we've discussed, I also think it's bad for floating rate credit. You will see a higher propensity to default. Doesn't mean there's not great bonds in the bank loan space. We find some great opportunities there. Because short-term rates are higher, you can find bonds that used to yield, you know, 3-4% that yield 8-9%, great credits. But just broadly speaking as a basket, the higher short-term rates stay up at the levels they are today, you will think that you would see more problems, especially if the economy starts slowing for some of these, you know, more below investment grade type credits.
And it's already becoming a problem for like the commercial real estate space, because Unlike, say, the corporate bond market, where the maturity wall has been pushed out for many borrowers, they took advantage of the low rate refinancing. We actually have quite a few deals that are coming up for refinancing, high profile backed loans. And so you're seeing weakness in, particularly in the office market, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. There's been some high profile buildings in the news where the basically the underlying landlords hand in the keys. What are you seeing in the commercial space? And is this a potential problem area systemically, not just for the holders of commercial mortgage-backed securities, but basically the underlying lenders, much of which resides with the small and medium-sized banking community?
Yeah, well, I think, CMBS has gotten hit on this for sure. Spreads have widened and you have a little bit of the baby going out with the bathwater. I mean, there's plenty of good bonds backed by other types of real estate other than other than office that are also getting hit. Office is really the big problem out there though. So it depends what kind of commercial bond you're buying. If you're in what's called the conduit space, this is traditional kind of 10-year fixed rate CMBS loans. You get kind of 25 to 50 million average balance loans. You pull together 20 to 35 loans. You package them up as bonds. Average deal probably has about 30% exposure to office. And that's that triple B that you mentioned. That's kind of the cuspy one that maybe that can get hit in some of these securities. There's another part of the commercial mortgage-backed securities market that's called single asset, single borrower. These are usually one large loan made to either on one property or a portfolio of properties backed by one operator, right? And they typically are larger, more well-capitalized operators. Think private equity, think REITs, think, you know, big well-capitalized sponsors. But actually those you can find bonds that have no office. It could be all hospitality. It could be all, you know, multifamily. It could be all retail, and certain retails, you know, not as bad as it used to be. So you can kind of mitigate your risk, right? You can kind of decrease exposure to office. We've been decreasing exposure to office at DoubleLine since the pandemic, just because we knew eventually the problems would come home to roost. The reason that they didn't was because leases are long-term and they hadn't rolled yet. So now you're getting closer to the roll on the lease. You're getting closer to the roll on the debt, as you were talking about, and it's coming to the forefront. And you get a couple big operators that default on their bonds, and it's all of a sudden the headlines, right? And that's kind of what's happening. People, one thing to think about though is the defaults are strategic defaults, right? These borrowers, they are somewhat in a position of power because the lender does not want the property. I mean, if I'm a bank and I have, you know, 39% of my portfolio in commercial loans, I do not want to take all those loans back at property and manage those. I don't have the capacity to do that, right? So what really is going to happen is a little bit of pretend and extend, which is the borrower is going to, you know, try to renegotiate terms. The bonds go into special servicing, or the borrower goes into special servicing, and they renegotiate the terms. And so what you're going to see is a lot of extension on securities, where a lot of these deals, they're like three-year loans with, like, you know, 3 to 5 year extension options. And so a lot of these transactions are going to extend, and you're going to go into special servicing. Bond price will obviously drop. Cash flows could get shut off, but it's not like these, all of a sudden you're going to see a wave of office properties being liquidated. Even during the GFC, we never actually saw that many liquidations. Everything just kind of went into the special servicing zone, and some things get liquidated and you'll see losses and whatnot, but that's kind of what's going to happen. And I think that the other pockets of real estate are still doing okay. I mean, yes, we probably overbuilt some industrial, but there's still decent demand there. Multifamily, you know, yes, we're overbuilding there as well, but because mortgage rates are so high, there's still rental demand. It's really office that's, I think, the big problem out there. And that can be ring-fenced as an investor and risk can be minimized, but that's going to be haunting us, I think, for years to come. I mean, if you look at some of the big metros, let's just take New York, for example, there's always good demand for really high quality, brand new commercial real estate with all the bells and whistles. But think about all
that. Well, and especially with all the green standards that are now being imposed by local municipalities that the older office buildings can't qualify for.
That's right. But think about all the Class B office that, you know, if in LA, we took some old bank buildings and we made them into like lofts and things like that. I mean, it's just so expensive to turn some of these buildings into lofts and or apartments. Even if somebody gave you the building for free, the economics may not work out. So I don't really have a good solution for all this office space. But what I will say is, as an investor, it's, you know, at least for now, we've tried to minimize our exposure and, you know, just be careful on, you know, trying to take advantage of opportunities on the other side. I don't think there's a quick rebound to this. There's going to be a long, drawn out process of what's happening with this type.
Yeah, it sounds like more bathwater than baby right now.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy.
Other areas of the securitized market that is starting to look more worrisome is credit card and auto loans, where the 90-day delinquency rates are continue to tick higher. Many of the larger lenders in this space are also seeing their underlying credit risk rise as well. Do you see kind of this being the next phase in broader weakness? I keep reading reports about how you have the SNAP benefits being pulled back, the pandemic level SNAP benefits being pulled back, Medicaid eligibility being pulled back, the expiration of the student loan moratorium, all these things that are going to pressure kind of the lower to middle part of the income demographic. Do you think this is all going to come to a head and we might start to see more losses show up in the securitized market as a result of higher delinquencies?
Yes, you will see higher losses, especially if you go into recession. There'll be, you know, unemployment will go up, defaults will go up, losses will go up. So then really, what really comes down to is bond structure. Did you know that during the global financial crisis, no subprime auto bonds actually took a loss? Pretty remarkable, right?
And well, that's because really people chose to pay off their auto loans before their mortgages, right?
You can't drive your house to work, right? that may be part of it. Another part of it really has to do with having acknowledged the risk of an asset class to begin with. And what the rating agencies, at least what their job is to predict losses during tough times. And so when they structured those subprime auto bonds, they looked at the borrowers and they said, okay, these are subprime borrowers. A lot of them are going to default, right? They're just going to default. They're 600 FICO borrowers. And then they said, okay, well, it's a used car. So most likely, right? And so if they default and we go to sell the car, usually cars depreciate. So there's going to be losses if the car needs to be sold at the auction. And when they were structuring the mortgage bonds, they said, well, looking back at history, it doesn't seem like anybody ever defaults because they usually sell the house and take their equity and walk away, right? And they also assumed really, really low losses. So when they structured the subprime auto bonds, they structured them in a way that there was enough what's called credit enhancement, meaning bonds below you that take losses before you get hit, and also over-collateralization, more loans than bonds, and also what's called excess spread, which is that there's extra coupon left over after you pay the bondholders that can cover losses. And the coupons on subprime auto loans are really high. They're like 20, 30, 40%. And if you have bond liabilities that, let's say, are like a weighted average of even like 6 or 7 today, you still have a ton of that excess spread. So a combination of those mechanisms helps insulate losses on these bonds. Now, the rating agencies could get it wrong. The underwriting quality of the subprime auto loans could be worse than the past and maybe default more. That particular segment of the economy from a demographic standpoint, as you suggested, could get hit harder. So what do you do as an investor? Well, if you're buying the triple A's or the investment grade bonds, I think you're fine, but I don't know if I'd be lining up to buy the first loss risk. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I think about the securitized market. The structure can mitigate risks. It doesn't mean that maybe headlines come into play, bond spreads widen a little bit more on those investment grade bonds and, you know, let's say prime credit cards, just because of the headline risk around it. But as far as taking a loss, I'm not worried in the investment grade portion, but perhaps I would be worried if I was buying more below investment grade or first loss, kind of like equity type risk in that space.
So how then important is it to the functioning of the overall securitized market if the primary issuance all of a sudden stops? And what I mean by that is we've seen in the headlines, for instance, that Santander had to pull a securitized deal. They're a major securitized lender in auto loans. And we've also saw in headlines that even investment grade pipelines have basically been shut down except for like the safest borrowers. To what extent is that more of a psychological impact on the overall health and functioning of the capital markets? Or does the market really need active primary issuance to kind of maintain overall liquidity and health?
The issuance could actually be a detractor to liquidity to the extent that there's too much issuance and not enough demand. That's really what drove spreads wider last year. We had record bond outflows from any bond funds, and we still had a lot of issuance last year, so that really helped to push spreads wider into the wides of October of last year. I think it really, as I search for liquidity, it's more about, is the street buying, is our money managers getting inflows to, have net demand to buy securities. So that to me really drives liquidity in the marketplace. The issuance, I think, is more of a problem for the issuers, right? If I'm an issuer, my main source of capital, if I'm not a bank, right, I'm just like, let's say I'm an auto issuer owned by a private equity company. I basically have a finite pool of capital. I go to the investment banks, I borrow and create warehouse lines where I'm going to originate loans and fill them on these warehouse lines until I get to critical mass. And then I'm going to go securitize and sell off a good portion, and I'm going to rinse repeat. And so if I cannot finance through the securitization market and have that securitization exit, at some point in time, my lenders are going to say, hold on, you got to stop making loans. Like, we're not going to keep making new warehouse lines for you. The lender in the middle, that Wall Street broker dealer, they like to finance those auto loans for a short period of time and then get the risk off their balance sheet, right? For like the first 6 to 12 months, your risk is probably pretty low. People aren't defaulting immediately, you would hope. Although there's people that obviously do. And so what that does is it starts putting pressure on those issuers. So if the new issue market shuts down, if I already bought the bonds, I'm fine. Street will provide liquidity here and there. It's really what happens to that issuer, because they've got another warehouse line behind that, And eventually they're going to get forced to liquidate those warehouse lines depending on when the tenor of that line ends. So I think the bigger problem when the new issue market dries up is really for who the issuers are in the securitized space. And that's a lot of small private equity owned companies, perhaps a lot of, non-bank originators. We've already seen some go under, right? You saw that happen last year with some of these non-agency, non-QM lenders, because they just got hung with loans that were down in price because rates went higher and they couldn't sell into the market anymore.
So, as we wrap up here, let's kind of canvas the fixed income segment, the securitized area of the segment. Where do you think the sort of risk reward asymmetrically favors investors? And where do you think perhaps there are more troubles that lie ahead?
I think we nailed the troubles. I would avoid office related investments. Doesn't mean CMBS is bad. You can find great CMBS bonds. In fact, you could argue that it's pushed spreads so wide that that's probably one of the cheaper pockets in the market if you can deal with the volatility. I definitely would try to avoid more subprime type credit. So in any space, you can't really even buy subprime residential mortgage loans. That's all made by the government now and Ginnie Mae bonds, FHA, VA. And so I would, in the securitized space, avoid commercial real estate, office related assets, try to stay away from the subprimey stuff. Some of the, bank loan exposure, you could think about, make sure you're with good managers if you're buying CLOs and
that collateralized loan obligations. Yep.
Yeah, that have navigated through the global financial crisis. I mean, a good manager should be able to dodge the losses through time. But really kind of the most interesting thing, especially if you're negative on the world, agency mortgage-backed securities, which have been super boring for almost the last decade because of quantitative easing, You know, the Fed was gobbling them all up. So the spreads were really tight. Rates were really low. Prepayments were really fast. So not much upside in price with fast prepayments. Mortgage-backed securities got rocked last year. The spreads widened pretty dramatically. The Fed stopped buying. All these banks stopped buying. So the spread, the nominal spread, is, you know, close to the widest levels that we've seen in over a decade, right? They're kind of like a 160-ish spread for current coupon, which is kind of the bond that's trading closest towards par. You know, in the GFC, they got out to kind of the mid-200s, but that's when Fannie and Freddie were going bust, which they did, right? They went out of business. We backstopped them. The government guaranteed, quasi-government guaranteed. The prepayment risk is super low because everyone's stuck in these 3 and 3.5% mortgages. Mortgage rates are like 6.5%. Rates could fall 200 basis points for mortgage rates and still nobody can refi, right? So I think that's a space that, again, was really boring for a long time, but I think looks pretty interesting. And it tends to do well in bad times. Rates fall, spreads don't widen that much on agency mortgages relative to corporates. And they benefit from kind of that duration pop like treasuries. Plus you get a little bit of spread. And today you get a lot more spread than you have in a long time. Mm-hmm. So I think agency mortgages are definitely worth a look in an asset allocation right now.
And that's on that note, we'll go ahead and wrap up our podcast here. Thank you again, Ken Shinodota, who oversees the structured products at Double Line Capital. And it was a pleasure having you on to hear your perspectives on both the banking sector, the Fed meeting, as well as the structured product space. My name is Ben Levine with 3DL Capital Management, the host of the Advisor Success Series podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you for listening to the Advisor Success Series podcast brought to you by 3DL Capital, a member of the Freedom Advisors Group. To stay up to date with our new podcast, be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. For more information about 3DL Capital, visit our website at 3DLfinancial.com.
The audio presentation represents Double Line's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the expressed written permission of Double Line. Double Line has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from Double Line, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither Double Line nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. Double Line is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any Double Line entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any Double Line entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2023, Double Line Capital.